Disc 4.
I want to ask you something, she said. Perhaps you'll think it terribly impertinent of me, but I want to know dreadfully, and you're probably the only person who could tell me. I believe you were once in love with my stepmother. He turned an astonished face towards her. With your stepmother? Yes. Helen Kennedy. Helen Halliday, as she became afterwards. I see. The man beside her was very quiet. His eyes looked out across the sunlit lawn unseeingly. The cigarette between his fingers smouldered. Quiet as he was, Gwenda sensed a turmoil within that taut figure, the arm of which touched her own. As though answering some question he had put to himself, Erskine said, "Letters, I suppose." Gwenda did not answer. "I never wrote her many. Two, perhaps three. She said she had destroyed them, but women never do destroy letters, do they? And so they came into your hands, and you want to know."
"I want to know more about her. I was very fond of her, although I was such a small child when she went away."
"She went away?
Didn't you know?"
His eyes, candid and surprised, met hers. "I've no news of her," he said, since that summer in Dilmouth."
"Then you don't know where she is now?"
"How should I? It's years ago, years. All finished and done with. Forgotten."
"Forgotten?"
He smiled rather bitterly. "No, perhaps not forgotten. You're very perceptive, Mrs. Reed. But tell me about her. She's not dead, is she?" A small cold wind sprang up suddenly, chilled their necks, and passed.
"I don't know if she is dead or not," said Gwenda. "I don't know anything about her. I thought perhaps you might know."
She went on as he shook his head.
"You see, she went away from Dilmouth that summer, quite suddenly one evening, without telling anyone, and she never came back."
"And you thought I might have heard from her?"
"Yes."
He shook his head. "No, never a word. But surely her brother, Dr. Chap, lives in Dilmouth. He must know. Or is he dead too?"
"No, he's alive, but he doesn't know either. You see, they all thought she went away with somebody."
He turned his head to look at her. Deep, sorrowful eyes. "They thought she went away with me."
"Well, it was a possibility."
"Was it a possibility? I don't think so. It was never that." "Or were we fools? Conscientious fools who passed up our chance of happiness."
Gwenda did not speak.
Again Erskine turned his head and looked at her. "Perhaps you'd better hear about it. There isn't really very much to hear. But I wouldn't like you to misjudge, Helen. We met on a boat going out to India. One of the children had been ill, and my wife was following on the next boat. Helen was going out to marry a man in the woods and forests, or something of that kind. She didn't love him. He was just an old friend, nice and kind, and she wanted to get away from home where she wasn't happy. We fell in love."
He paused.
"Always a bald kind of statement. But it wasn't, I want to make that quite clear, just the usual shipboard love affair. It was serious. We were both, well, shattered by it. And there wasn't anything to be done. I couldn't let Janet and the children down. Helen saw it the same way as I did. If it had been only Janet, but there were the boys. It was all hopeless. We agreed to say goodbye and try and forget." He laughed a short, mirthless laugh. "Forget? I never forgot. Not for one moment. Life was just a living hell. I couldn't stop thinking about Helen. Well, she didn't marry the chap she'd been going out to marry. At the last moment she just couldn't face it. She went home to England, and on the way she met this other man, your father, I suppose. She wrote to me a couple of months later, telling me what she had done. He was very unhappy over the loss of his wife, she said, and there was a child. She thought that she could make him happy, and that it was the best thing to do. She wrote from Dilmouth. About 8 months later, my father died, and I came into this place. I sent in my papers, and came back to England. We wanted a few weeks' holiday until we could get into this house. My wife suggested Dilmouth. Some friend had mentioned it as a pretty place and quiet. She didn't know, of course, about Helen. Can you imagine the temptation? To see her again. To see what this man she had married was like. There was a short silence. Then Erskine said, "We came and stayed at the Royal Clarence. It was a mistake. Seeing Helen again was hell. She seemed happy enough on the whole. I didn't know whether she cared still or whether she didn't. Perhaps she'd got over it. My wife, I think, suspected something. She's a very jealous woman, always has been." He added brusquely, "That's all there is to it. We left Dilmouth on August the 17th, said Gwenda. "Was that the date? Probably, I can't remember exactly. "It was a Saturday," said Gwenda. "Yes, you're right. I remember Janet said it might be a crowded day to travel north, but I don't think it was." "Please try and remember, Major Erskine. When was the last time you saw my stepmother, Helen?" He smiled a gentle, tired smile. "I don't need to try very hard. I saw her the evening before we left, on the beach. I'd strolled down there after dinner, and she was there. There was no one else about. I walked up with her to her house. We went through the garden."
"What time?"
"I don't know. 9 o'clock, I suppose."
"And you said goodbye?"
"And we said goodbye."
Again he laughed.
"Oh, not the kind of goodbye you're thinking of. It was very brusque and curt. Helen said, 'Please go away now, go quickly. I'd rather not—' She stopped then, and I just went."
"Back to the hotel?"
"Yes, yes, eventually. I walked a long way first, right out into the country."
Gwenda said, "It's difficult with dates after so many years, but I think that that was the night she went away and didn't come back."
"I see. And as I and my wife left the next day, people gossiped and said she'd gone away with me. Charming minds people have."
"Anyway," said Gwenda bluntly, "she didn't go away with you."
"Good Lord, no. There was never any question of such a thing."
"Then why do you think," asked Gwenda, "that she went away?"
Erskine frowned. His manner changed, became interested. "I see," he said. "That is a bit of a problem. She didn't leave any explanation?" Gwenda considered. Then she voiced her own belief.
"I don't think she left any word at all. Do you think she went away with someone else?"
"No, of course she didn't."
"You seem rather sure about that."
"I am sure."
"Then why did she go?"
"If she went off suddenly like that, I can only see one possible reason. She was running away from me."
"From you?"
"Yes. She was afraid, perhaps, that I'd try to see her again, that I'd pester her. She must have seen that I was still crazy about her. Yes, that must have been it."
"It doesn't explain," said Gwenda, "why she never came back. Tell me, did Helen say anything to you about my father? That she was worried about him or afraid of him, anything like that?"
"Afraid of him? Why?"
"Oh, I see. You thought he might have been jealous."
"Was he a jealous man?"
"I don't know. He died when I was a child."
"Oh, I see. No, looking back, he always seemed normal and pleasant. He was fond of Helen, proud of her. I don't think more. No, I was the one who was jealous of him."
"They seemed to you reasonably happy together?"
"Yes, they did. I was glad, and yet at the same time it hurt to see it. No, Helen never discussed him with me. As I tell you, we were hardly ever alone.
never confidential together. But now that you have mentioned it, I do remember thinking that Helen was worried.
Worried?
Yes, I thought perhaps it was because of my wife.
He broke off.
But it was more than that.
He looked again sharply at Gwenda.
Was she afraid of her husband? Was he jealous of other men where she was concerned?
You seem to think not.
Jealousy is a very queer thing. It can hide itself sometimes so that you'd never suspect it.
He gave a short, quick shiver.
But it can be frightening. Very frightening.
Another thing I would like to know.
Gwenda broke off.
A car had come up the drive.
Major Erskine said, "Ah, my wife has come back from shopping."
In a moment, as it were, he became a different person.
His tone was easy, yet formal, his face expressionless. A slight tremor betrayed that he was nervous. Mrs. Erskine came striding round the corner of the house. Her husband went towards her. "Mrs. Reed dropped one of her rings in the garden yesterday," she said.
Mrs. Erskine said abruptly,
"Indeed."
"Good morning," said Gwenda. "Yes, luckily I have found it."
"That's very fortunate."
"Oh, it is. I should have hated to lose it. Well, I must be going."
Mrs. Erskine said nothing. Major Erskine said, "I'll see you to your car." He started to follow Gwenda along the terrace. His wife's voice came sharply. "Richard, if Mrs. Reed will excuse you, there is a very important call."
Gwenda said hastily, "Oh, that's quite all right. Please don't bother."
She ran quickly along the terrace and round the side of the house to the drive. Then she stopped. Mrs. Erskine had drawn up her car in such a way that Gwenda doubted whether she could get her own car past and down the drive. She hesitated, then slowly retraced her steps to the terrace. Just short of the French windows, she stopped dead. Mrs. Erskine's voice, deep and resonant, came distinctly to her ears.
"I don't care what you say. You arranged it yesterday. You fixed it up with that girl to come here whilst I was in Daith. You're always the same. Any pretty girl, I won't stand it, I tell you, I won't stand it."
Erskine's voice cut in, quiet, almost despairing. "Sometimes, Janet, I really think you're insane."
"I'm not the one who's insane. It's you. You can't leave women alone."
"You know that's not true, Janet."
"It is true. Even long ago in the place where this girl comes from, Dilmouth. Do you dare tell me that you weren't in love with that yellow-haired Halliday woman?"
"Can you never forget anything? Why must you go on harping on these things? You simply work yourself up, and
it's you. You break my heart. I won't stand it, I tell you, I won't stand it. Planning assignations, laughing at me behind my back. You don't care for me. You've never cared for me. I'll kill myself. I'll throw myself over a cliff. I wish I were dead."
"Janet, Janet, for God's sake." The deep voice had broken. The sound of passionate sobbing floated out into the summer air. On tiptoe, Gwenda crept away and round into the drive again. She cogitated for a moment, then rang the front doorbell.
"I wonder," she said, "if there is anyone who could move this car? I don't think I can get out."
The servant went into the house. Presently, a man came round from what had been the stable yard. He touched his cap to Gwenda, got into the Austin, and drove it into the yard. Gwenda got into her car and drove rapidly back to the hotel where Giles was waiting for her.
"What a time you've been," he greeted her. "Get anything?"
"Yes, I know all about it now. It's really rather pathetic. He was terribly in love with Helen." She narrated the events of the morning.
"I really think," she ended, "that Mrs. Erskine is a bit insane. She sounded quite mad. I see now what he meant by jealousy. It must be awful to feel like that. Anyway, we know now that Erskine wasn't the man who went away with Helen, and that he knows nothing about her death. She was alive that evening when he left her."
"Yes," said Giles. "At least, that's what he says." Gwenda looked indignant.
"That," repeated Giles firmly, "is what he says."
Chapter 18. Bindweed. Miss Marple bent down on the terrace outside the French window and dealt with some insidious bindweed.
It was only a minor victory, since beneath the surface the bindweed remained in possession, as always, but at least the delphiniums knew a temporary deliverance. Mrs. Cocker appeared in the drawing-room window. "Excuse me, madam, but Dr. Kennedy has called. He is anxious to know how long Mr. and Mrs. Reed will be away, and I told him I couldn't take it upon myself to say exactly, but that you might know. Shall I ask him to come out here?"
"Oh, yes, please, Mrs. Cocker."
Mrs. Cocker reappeared shortly afterwards with Dr. Kennedy. Rather flutteringly, Miss Marple introduced herself.
"And I arranged with dear Gwenda that I would come round and do a little weeding while she was away. I think you know that my young friends are being imposed upon by their jobbing gardener, Foster. He comes twice a week, drinks a great many cups of tea, does a lot of talking, and not, as far as I can see, very much work."
"Yes," said Dr. Kennedy rather absently. "Yes, they're all alike, all alike." Miss Marple looked at him appraisingly. He was an older man than she had thought from the Reed's description of him. Prematurely old, she guessed. He looked too both worried and unhappy. He stood there, his fingers caressing the long, pugnacious line of his jaw.
"They've gone away," he said. "Do you know for how long?"
"Oh, not for long. They have gone to visit some friends in the north of England. Young people seem to me so restless, always dashing about here and there."
"Yes," said Dr. Kennedy. "Yes, that's true enough." He paused, and then said rather diffidently, "Young Giles Reed wrote and asked me for some papers, letters, if I could find them." He hesitated, and Miss Marple said quietly,
"Your sister's letters?"
He shot her a quick, shrewd glance. "So, you're in their confidence, are you? A relation?"
"Only a friend," said Miss Marple. "I have advised them to the best of my capacity. But people seldom take advice. A pity, perhaps, but there it is."
"What was your advice?" he asked curiously.
"To let sleeping murder lie," said Miss Marple firmly.
Dr. Kennedy sat down heavily on an uncomfortable rustic seat. "That's not badly put," he said. "I'm fond of Gwenny. She was a nice small child. I should judge that she's grown up to be a nice young woman. I'm afraid that she's heading for trouble."
"There are so many kinds of trouble," said Miss Marple.
"Eh?" "Yes, yes, true enough." He sighed. Then he said, "Giles Reed wrote and asked me if I could let him have my sister's letters, written after she left here, and also some authentic specimen of her handwriting." He shot a keen glance at her. "You see what that means?"
Miss Marple nodded. "I think so."
"They're harking back to the idea that Kelvin Halliday, when he said he had strangled his wife, was speaking neither more nor less than the truth. They believe that the letters my sister Helen wrote after she went away weren't written by her at all, that they were forgeries. They believe that she never left this house alive."
Miss Marple said gently, "And you are not, by now, so very sure yourself?"
"I was at the time."
Kennedy still stared ahead of him.
"It seemed absolutely clear. Pure hallucination on Kelvin's part. There was no body. A suitcase and clothes were taken. What else could I think?"
"And your sister had been recently rather..." Miss Marple coughed delicately. "Interested in a certain gentleman?"
Dr. Kennedy looked at her. There was deep pain in his eyes. "I loved my sister," he said, "but I have to admit that with Helen there was always some man in the offing. There are women who are made that way. They can't help it."
"It all seemed clear to you at the time," said Miss Marple, "but it does not seem so clear now. Why?"
"Because," said Kennedy with frankness, "it seems incredible to me that if Helen is still alive, she has not communicated with me all these years. In the same way, if she is dead, it is equally strange that I have not been notified of the fact." "Well,"
he got up. He took a packet from his pocket.
"Here is the best I can do. The first letter I received from Helen I must have destroyed. I can find no trace of it. But I did keep the second one, the one that gave the Poste Restante address. And here, for comparison, is the only bit of Helen's handwriting I've been able to find.
It's a list of bulbs, etc., for planting. A copy that she had kept of some order. The handwriting of the order and the letter look alike to me, but then I'm no expert. I'll leave them here for Giles and Gwenda when they return. It's probably not worth forwarding.
Oh, no. I believe they expect to return tomorrow, or the next day.
The doctor nodded. He stood, looking along the terrace, his eyes still absent. He said suddenly, "You know what's worrying me? If Kelvin Halliday did kill his wife, he must have concealed the body or got rid of it in some way. And that means, I don't know what else it can mean, that his story to me was a cleverly made-up tale, that he'd already hidden a suitcase full of clothes to give colour to the idea that Helen had gone away, that he'd even arranged for letters to arrive from abroad. It means, in fact, that it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder. Little Gwenny was a nice child. It would be bad enough for her to have a father who's paranoiac, but it's 10 times worse to have a father who's a deliberate murderer." He swung round to the open window. Miss Marple arrested his departure by a swift question. "Who was your sister afraid of, Dr. Kennedy?" He turned back to her and stared. "Afraid of? No one, as far as I know."
"I only wondered. Pray excuse me if I'm asking indiscreet questions, but there was a young man, wasn't there? I mean, some entanglement, when she was very young. Somebody called Affleck, I believe."
"Oh, that. Silly business most girls go through. An undesirable young fellow. Shifty. And, of course, not her class, not her class at all. He got into trouble here afterwards."
"I just wondered if he could have been revengeful."
Dr. Kennedy smiled rather sceptically. "Oh, I don't think it went deep. Anyway, as I say, he got into trouble here and left the place for good."
"What sort of trouble?"
"Oh, nothing criminal. Just indiscretions. Blabbed about his employer's affairs."
"And his employer was Mr. Walter Fane?"
Dr. Kennedy looked a little surprised. "Yes. Yes, now you say so. I remember he did work in Fane and Watchman's. Not articled, just an ordinary clerk."
"Just an ordinary clerk?"
Miss Marple wondered, as she stooped again to the bindweed, after Dr. Kennedy had gone. Chapter 19. Mr. Kimball Speaks.
"Well, I don't know, I'm sure," said Mrs. Kimball. Her husband, driven into speech by what was neither more nor less than an outrage, became vocal. He shoved his cup forward.
"What's you thinking of, Lily?" he demanded. "No sugar!"
Mrs. Kimball hastily remedied the outrage, and then proceeded to elaborate on her own theme.
"Thinking about this advertisement, I am," she said. "Lily Abbott, it says, plain as plain, and formerly house parlourmaid at St. Catherine's, Dilmouth. That's me, all right."
"Ar,"
agreed Mr. Kimball.
"After all these years, you must agree it's odd, Jim."
"Ar,"
said Mr. Kimball.
"Well, what am I going to do, Jim?"
"Leave it be."
"Suppose there's money in it."
There was a gurgling sound as Mr. Kimball drained his teacup to fortify himself for the mental effort of embarking on a long speech. He pushed his cup along and prefaced his remarks with a laconic, "More." Then he got under way.
"You went on a lot at one time about what happened at St. Catherine's. I didn't take much account of it. Reckoned it was mostly foolishness, women's chatter. Ah, maybe it wasn't. Maybe summat did happen. If so, it's police business, and you don't want to get mixed up in it. All over and done with, ain't it? You leave well alone, my girl."
"Oh, very well to say that. It may be money as has been left me in a will. Maybe Mrs. Halliday's alive all the time, and now she's dead, and left me summat in her will."
"Left you summat in her will? What for?"
"Ah,"
said Mr. Kimball, reverting to his favourite monosyllable to express scorn.
"Even if it's police. You know, Jim, there's a big reward sometimes for anyone as can give information to catch a murderer."
"And what could you give? Or you know you made up yourself in your head."
"That's what you say, but I've been thinking."
"Ah,"
said Mr. Kimball disgustedly.
"Well, I have. Ever since I saw that first piece in the paper. Maybe I got things a bit wrong. That Leonie, she was a bit stupid like all foreigners, couldn't understand proper what you said to her, and her English was somewhat awful. If she didn't mean what I thought she meant. I've been trying to remember the name of that man. Now, if it was him she saw. Remember that picture I told you about? Secret lover? Oh, ever so exciting. They tracked him down in the end through his car. $50,000 he paid the garage man to forget he filled up with petrol that night. Dunno what that is in pounds. And the other one was there too, and the husband, crazy with jealousy. All mad about it they were. And in the end, Mr. Kimball pushed back his chair with a grating sound. He rose to his feet with slow and ponderous authority. Preparatory to leaving the kitchen, he delivered an ultimatum, the ultimatum of a man who, though usually inarticulate, had a certain shrewdness. "You leave the whole thing alone, my girl," he said, "or else, likely as not, you'll be sorry." He went into the scullery, put on his boots — Lily was particular about her kitchen floor — and went out. Lily sat on at the table, her sharp, foolish little brain working things out. Of course, she couldn't exactly go against what her husband said, but all the same, Jim was so hide-bound, so stick-in-the-mud. She wished there was somebody else she could ask, somebody who would know all about rewards and the police and what it all meant. Pity to turn up a chance of good money. That wireless set, the home perm, that cherry-coloured coat in Russell's, ever so smart, even maybe a whole Jacobean suite for the sitting-room. Eager, greedy, short-sighted, she went on dreaming. What exactly had Leonie said all those years ago? Then an idea came to her. She got up and fetched the bottle of ink, the pen, and a pad of writing paper. "Know what I'll do," she said to herself. "I'll write to the doctor, Mrs. Halliday's brother. He'll tell me what I ought to do, if he's alive still, that is. Anyway, it's on my conscience I never told him about Leonie, or about that car." There was silence for some time, apart from the laborious scratching of Lily's pen. It was very seldom that she wrote a letter, and she found the composition of it a considerable effort. However, it was done at last, and she put it into an envelope and sealed it up. But she felt less satisfied than she had expected. 10 to 1 the doctor was dead or had gone away from Dilmouth. Was there anyone else? What was the name now of that fellow? If only she could remember that. Chapter 20. The Girl Helen. Giles and Gwenda had just finished breakfast on the morning after their return from Northumberland when Miss Marple was announced. She came rather apologetically. "I'm afraid this is a very early call. Not a thing I'm in the habit of doing, but there was something I wanted to explain."
"We're delighted to see you," said Giles, pulling out a chair for her. "Do have a cup of coffee."
"Oh, no, no, thank you. Nothing at all. I have breakfasted most adequately. Now, let me explain. I came in whilst you were away, as you kindly said I might, to do a little weeding."
"Angelic of you," said Gwenda.
"And it really did strike me that 2 days a week is not quite enough for this garden. In any case, I think Foster is taking advantage of you. Too much tea and too much talk. I found out that he couldn't manage another day himself, so I took it upon myself to engage another man, just for 1 day a week, Wednesdays. Today, in fact."
Giles looked at her curiously. He was a little surprised. It might be kindly meant, but Miss Marple's action savoured very faintly of interference, and interference was unlike her. He said slowly, "Foster's far too old, I know, for really hard work."
"I'm afraid, Mr. Reed, that Manning is even older. 75, he tells me. But you see, I thought employing him, just for a few odd days, might be quite an advantageous move, because he used, many years ago, to be employed at Dr. Kennedy's. The name of the young man Helen got engaged to was Afflick, by the way."
"Miss Marple," said Giles, "I maligned you in thought. You are a genius. You know I've got those specimens of Helen's handwriting from Kennedy."
"I know. I was here when he brought them."
"I'm posting them off today.
I got the address of a good handwriting expert last week.
Let's go into the garden and see Manning, said Gwenda.
Manning was a bent, crabbed-looking old man with a roomy and slightly cunning eye. The pace at which he was raking a path accelerated noticeably as his employers drew near.
"Morning, sir. Morning, ma'am. The lady said as how you could do with a little extra help of a Wednesday. I'll be pleased. Shameful neglected, this place it looks."
"I'm afraid the garden's been allowed to run down for some years."
"Oh, it has that. Remember it, I do, in Mrs. Findison's time. A picture it were then. Very fond of her garden she was, Mrs. Findison."
Giles leaned easily against a roller. Gwenda snipped off some rose heads. Miss Marple, retreating a little upstage, bent to the bindweed. Old Manning leant on his rake. All was set for a leisurely morning discussion of old times and gardening in the good old days.
"I suppose you know most of the gardens round here," said Giles encouragingly.
"Ah, I know this place moderate well, I do, and the fancies people went in for. Mrs. Yule, up at Niagara, she had a yew hedge used to be clipped like a squirrel. Silly, I thought it. Peacocks is one thing, and squirrels is another. Then Colonel Lampard, he was a great man for begonias. Lovely beds of begonias he used to have. Bedding out now, that's gone out of fashion. I wouldn't like to tell you how often I've had to fill up beds in the front lawns and turf them over in the last 6 years. Seems people ain't got no eye for geraniums and a nice bit of lobelia edging no more."
"You worked at Dr. Kennedy's, didn't you?"
"Ah, long time ago, that were. Must have been 1920 and on. He's moved now, given up. Young Dr. Brent's up at Crosby Lodge now. Funny ideas he has. Little white tablets and so on. Vitty pins, he calls them."
"I suppose you remember Miss Helen Kennedy, the doctor's sister?"
"Oh, I remember Miss Helen right enough. Pretty maid she was, with her long yellow hair. The doctor set a lot of store by her. Come back and lived in this very house here, she did, after she was married. Army gentleman from India."
"Yes," said Gwenda, "we know."
"Aye, I did hear, Saturday night it was, as you and your husband was some kind of relations. Pretty as a picture Miss Helen was, when she first come back from school. Full of fun, too. Wanting to go everywhere, dances and tennis and all that. Had to mark out the tennis court I had. Hadn't been used for nigh 20 years, I'd say. And the shrubs overgrowing it cruel. Had to cut 'em back, I did. And get a lot of whitewash and mark out the lines. Lot of work it made. And in the end, hardly played on. Funny thing, I always thought that was."
"What was a funny thing?" asked Giles.
"Business with the tennis court. Someone come along one night and cut it to ribbons. Just to ribbons it was. Spite, as you might say. That was what it was. Nasty bit of spite."
"But who would do a thing like that?"
"Oh, that's what the doctor wanted to know. Proper put out about it he was, and I don't blame him. Just paid for it he had. But none of us could tell who done it. We never did know. And he said he wasn't going to get another. Quite right, too, for if it's spite one time, it'd be spite again. But Miss Helen, she was rare and put out. She didn't have no luck, Miss Helen didn't. First that net, and then her bad foot."
"A bad foot?" asked Gwenda.
"Yeah, fell over a scraper or some such and cut it. Not much more than a graze, it seemed, but 'twouldn't heal. Fair worried about it, the doctor was. He was dressing it and treating it, but it didn't get well. I remember him saying, 'I can't understand it. There must have been some spectic, or some word like that, on the scraper. And anyway,' he says, 'what was the scraper doing out in the middle of the drive?' Because that's where 'twas, where Miss Helen fell over it, walking home on a dark night. Oh, the poor maid, there she was, missing, going to dances, and sitting about with her foot up. Seemed as though there was nothing but bad luck for her."
The moment had come, Giles thought. He asked casually,
Do you remember somebody called Affleck?
Oh, are. You mean Jackie Affleck, as was in Fane and Watchman's office?
Yes. Wasn't he a friend of Miss Helen's?
Oh, that were just a bit of nonsense. Doctor put a stop to it, and quite right, too. He weren't any class, Jackie Affleck. And he was the kind that's too sharp by half. Cut himself in the end, that kind do. But he weren't here long. Got himself into hot water. Good riddance. Uston won the likes of he in Dilmouth. Won't be smart somewhere else. That's what he were welcome to do.
Gwenda said, "Was he here when that tennis net was cut up?"
Ah, I see what you're thinking. But he wouldn't do a senseless thing like that. He were smart, Jackie Affleck were. Whoever did that, it was just spite.
Was there anybody who had a down on Miss Helen who would be likely to feel spiteful? Old Manning chuckled softly.
Oh, some of the young ladies might have felt spiteful all right. Not a patch on Miss Helen to look at, most of them weren't. No, I'd say that was done just in foolishness. Some tramp with a grudge.
Was Helen very upset about Jackie Affleck? Asked Gwenda.
Don't think as Miss Helen cared much about any of the young fellers. Just liked to enjoy herself, that's all. Very devoted, some of them were. Young Mr. Walter Fane, for one, used to follow her round like a dog.
But she didn't care for him at all?
Nah, not Miss Helen. Just laugh, that's all she did. Went abroad to foreign parts, he did. But he come back later. Top one in the firm he is now. Never married. I don't blame him. Women causes a lot of trouble in a man's life.
Are you married? Asked Gwenda.
Buried too, I have, said old Manning. Ah, well, I can't complain. Smoke me pipe in peace where I likes now.
In the ensuing silence, he picked up his rake again. Giles and Gwenda walked back up the path towards the house, and Miss Marple, desisting from her attack on bindweed, joined them. "Miss Marple," said Gwenda, "you don't look well. Is there anything—" "It's nothing, my dear." The old lady paused for a moment before saying, with a strange kind of insistence, "You know, I don't like that bit about the tennis net, cutting it to ribbons. Even then—" She stopped. Giles looked at her curiously. "I don't quite understand," he began. "Don't you? It seems so horribly plain to me. But perhaps it's better that you shouldn't understand. And anyway, perhaps I am wrong. Now, do tell me how you got on in Northumberland." They gave her an account of their activities, and Miss Marple listened attentively. "It's really all very sad," said Gwenda. "Quite tragic, in fact." "Yes, indeed. Poor thing. Poor thing. That's what I felt. How that man must suffer." "He? Oh, yes, yes, of course. But you meant—" "Well, yes, I was thinking of her, of the wife. Probably very deeply in love with him, and he married her because she was suitable, or because he was sorry for her, or for one of those quite kindly and sensible reasons that men often have, and which are actually so terribly unfair. I know 100 ways of love, and each one makes the loved one rue," quoted Giles softly. Miss Marple turned to him. "Yes, that is so true. Jealousy, you know, is usually not an affair of causes. It is much more, how shall I say, fundamental than that, based on the knowledge that one's love is not returned, and so one goes on waiting, watching, expecting that the loved one will turn to someone else, which again invariably happens. So this Mrs. Erskine has made life a hell for her husband, and he, without being able to help it, has made life a hell for her. But I think she has suffered most. And yet, you know, I dare say he is really quite fond of her."
"He can't be," cried Gwenda.
"Oh, my dear, you are very young. He has never left his wife, and that means something, you know."
"Because of the children, because it was his duty."
"The children, perhaps," said Miss Marple. "But I must confess that gentlemen do not seem to me to have a great regard for duty in so far as their wives are concerned. Public service is another matter." Giles laughed,
"'What a wonderful cynic you are, Miss Marple. "'Oh, dear, Mr. Reed, I do hope not that. "'One always has hope for human nature. "'I still don't feel it can have been Walter Fane,' said Gwenda thoughtfully. "'And I'm sure it wasn't Major Erskine. "'In fact, I know it wasn't.' "'One's feelings are not always reliable guides,' said Miss Marple. "'The most unlikely people do things. "'Quite a sensation there was in my own little village "'when the treasurer of the Christmas Club "'was found to have put every penny of the funds on a horse. "'He disapproved of horse racing, "'and indeed any kind of betting or gambling. "'His father had been a turf agent "'and had treated his mother very badly. "'So, intellectually speaking, he was quite sincere.' But he chanced one day to be motoring near Newmarket, and saw some horses training, and then it all came over him. Blood does tell.
The antecedents of both Walter Fane and Richard Erskine seem above suspicion, said Giles gravely, but with a slight amused twist to his mouth. But then, murder is by way of being an amateur crime.
The important thing is, said Miss Marple, that they were there. On the spot. Walter Fane was here in Dilmouth. Major Erskine, by his own account, must actually have been with Helen Halliday very shortly before her death, and he did not return to his hotel for some time that night.
But he was quite frank about it. He...
Gwenda broke off. Miss Marple was looking at her very hard. I only want to emphasize, said Miss Marple, the importance of being... On the spot. She looked from one to the other of them. Then she said, I think you will have no trouble in finding out J.J. Affleck's address. As proprietor of the Daffodil Coaches, it should be easy enough.
Giles nodded. I'll get on to it, probably in the telephone directory.
He paused.
You think we should go and see him?
Miss Marple waited for a moment or two. Then she said, If you do, you must be very careful. Remember what that old gardener just said. Jackie Affleck is smart. Please, please, be careful.
Chapter 21 J.J. Affleck J.J. Affleck, Daffodil Coaches, Devon and Dorset Tours, etc., had two numbers listed in the telephone book, an office address in Exeter and a private address on the outskirts of that town. An appointment was made for the following day. Just as Giles and Gwenda were leaving in the car, Mrs. Cocker ran out and gesticulated. Giles put on the brake and stopped.
"'It's Dr. Kennedy on the telephone, sir.'
Giles got out and ran back. He picked up the receiver. "'Giles Reed, here.'
"'Morning. I've just received rather an odd letter from a woman called Lily Kimball. I've been racking my brains to remember who she is.' Thought of a patient first, that put me off the scent. But I rather fancy she must be a girl who was in service once at your house. House parlour-maid at the time we know of. I'm almost sure her name was Lily, though I don't recollect her last name.
There was a Lily. Gwenda remembers her. She tied a bow on the cat.
Gwenny must have a very remarkable memory.
Oh, she has.
Well, I'd like to have a word with you about this letter, not over the phone. Will you be in if I come over?
We are just on our way to Exeter.
We could drop in on you if you prefer, sir. It's all on our way.
Good. That'll do splendidly.
I don't like to talk too much about all this over the phone, explained the doctor when they arrived. I always have an idea the local exchanges listen in. Here's the woman's letter.
He spread the letter on the table. It was written on cheap lined paper in an uneducated hand.
Dear Sir, Lily Kimball had written. I'd be grateful if you could give me advice about the enclosed what I cut out of paper. I've been thinking, and I talked it over with Mr. Kimball, but I don't know what's best to do about it. Do you think as it means money or a reward? Because I could do with the money, I'm sure, but wouldn't want the police or anything like that. I often have been thinking about that night when Mrs. Halliday went away, and I don't think, sir, she ever did. "'Because the clothes was wrong. "'I thought at first the master done it, "'but now I'm not so sure, "'because of the car I saw out of the window. "'A posh car it was,
and I seen it before, but I wouldn't like to do anything without asking you first if it was all right, and not police, because I never have mixed up with police, and Mr. Kimball wouldn't like it. I could come and see you, sir, if I may, next Thursday, as it's market day, and Mr. Kimball will be out. I'd be very grateful if you could. Yours respectfully, Lily Kimball.
It was addressed to my old house in Dilmouth, said Kennedy, and forwarded on to me here. The cutting is your advertisement.
It's wonderful, said Gwenda. This Lily, you see, she doesn't think it was my father who did it. She spoke with jubilation.
Dr. Kennedy looked at her with tired, kindly eyes. Good for you, Gwenny, he said gently. I hope you're right. Now, this is what I think we'd better do. I'll answer her letter and tell her to come here on Thursday. The train connection is quite good. By changing at Dilmouth Junction, she can get here shortly after 4:30. If you two will come over that afternoon, we can tackle her together.
Splendid, said Giles.
He glanced at his watch. Come on, Gwenda, we must hurry. We've got an appointment, he explained, with Mr. Affleck of the Daffodil Coaches, and, so he told us, he's a busy man.
Affleck? Kennedy frowned.
Of course! Devon Tours in Daffodil Coaches. Horrible great butter-coloured brutes. But the name seemed familiar in some other way.
Helen, said Gwenda.
My goodness, not that chap.
Yes.
But he was a miserable little rat. So he's come up in the world.
Will you tell me something, sir? Said Giles. You broke up some funny business between him and Helen. Was that simply because of his, well, social position?
Dr. Kennedy gave him a dry glance. I'm old-fashioned, young man. In the modern gospel, one man is as good as another. That holds morally, no doubt. But I'm a believer in the fact that there is a state of life into which you are born, and I believe you're happiest staying in it. Besides, he added, I thought the fellow was a wrong one, as he proved to be.
What did he do exactly?
That I can't remember now. It was a case, as far as I can recall, of his trying to cash in on some information obtained through his employment with Thane, some confidential matter relating to one of their clients.
Was he sore about his dismissal?
Kennedy gave him a sharp glance and said briefly, Yes.
And there wasn't any other reason at all for your disliking his friendship with your sister? You didn't think he was, well, odd in any way?
Since you have brought the matter up, I will answer you frankly. It seemed to me, especially after his dismissal from his employment, that Jackie Affleck displayed certain signs of an unbalanced temperament. Incipient persecution mania, in fact. But that does not seem to have been borne out by his subsequent rise in life.
Who dismissed him? Walter Fane?
I have no idea if Walter Fane was concerned. He was dismissed by the firm.
And he complained that he had been victimized?
Kennedy nodded. I see. Well, we must drive like the wind. Till Thursday, sir.
The house was newly built. It was of snowcrete, heavily curved, with a big expanse of window. They were shown in through an opulent hall to a study, half of which was taken up by a big chromium-plated desk. Gwenda murmured nervously to Giles,
Really, I don't know what we should have done with that Miss Marple. We lean upon her at every turn, first her friends in Northumberland, and now her vicar's wife's boys' club annual outing.
Giles raised an admonitory hand as the door opened, and J.J. Affleck surged into the room. He was a stout man of middle age, dressed in a rather violently checked suit. His eyes were dark and shrewd, his face rubicund and good-natured. He looked like the popular idea of a successful bookmaker.
Mr. Reed, good morning. Pleased to meet you.
Giles introduced Gwenda. She felt her hand taken in a rather overzealous grip.
"'And what can I do for you, Mr. Reed?'
Affleck sat down behind his huge desk. He offered cigarettes from an onyx box. Giles entered upon the subject of the boys' club outing. Old friends of his ran the show. He was anxious to arrange a couple of days' touring in Devon. Affleck replied promptly in a businesslike manner, quoting prices and making suggestions, but there was a faintly puzzled look on his face. Finally, he said,
Well, that's clear enough, Mr. Reed, and I'll send you a line to confirm it. But this is strictly office business. I understood from my clerk that you wanted a private appointment at my private address.
We did, Miss Raflick. There were actually two matters on which I wanted to see you. We've disposed of one. The other is a purely private matter. My wife here is very anxious to get in touch with her stepmother, whom she has not seen for many years, and we wondered if you could possibly help us.
Well, if you tell me the lady's name, I gather that I'm acquainted with her?
You were acquainted with her at one time. Her name is Helen Halliday, and before her marriage she was Miss Helen Kennedy.
Affleck sat quite still.
He screwed up his eyes and tilted his chair slowly backwards.
Helen Halliday. I don't recall. Helen Kennedy.
Formerly of Dilmouth, said Gwenda. The legs of Affleck's chair came down sharply.
Got it, he said. Of course.
His round, rubicund face beamed with pleasure.
Little Helen Kennedy. Yeah, I remember her. But it's a long time ago. Must be 20 years.
18.
Is it really? Time flies, as the saying goes. But I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed, Mrs. Reed. I haven't seen anything of Helen since that time. Never heard of her, even.
Oh, dear, said Gwenda. That's very disappointing. We did so hope you could help.
What's the trouble?
His eyes flickered quickly from one face to another.
Quarrel? Left home? Matter of money?
Gwenda said, she went away, suddenly, from Dilmouth. 18 years ago, with someone.
Jackie Affleck said amusedly. And you thought she might have gone away with me. Now, why?
Gwenda spoke boldly. Because we heard that you and she had once been, well, fond of each other.
Me and Helen? Oh, but there was nothing in that. Just a boy and girl affair. Neither of us took it seriously,
he added dryly.
We weren't encouraged to do so.
You must think us dreadfully impertinent, began Gwenda, but he interrupted her.
What's the odds? I'm not sensitive. You want to find a certain person, and you think I may be able to help? Ask me anything you please. I've naught to conceal.
He looked at her thoughtfully.
So, you're Halliday's daughter?
Yes. Did you know my father? He shook his head.
I dropped in to see Helen once when I was over at Dilmouth on business. I'd heard she was married and living there. She was civil enough.
He paused.
But she didn't ask me to stay to dinner. No, I didn't meet your father.
Had there, Gwenda wondered, been a trace of rancour in that she didn't ask me to stay to dinner? Did she, if you remember, seem happy?
Affleck shrugged his shoulders. Happy enough. But there, it's a long time ago. I'd have remembered if she'd looked unhappy.
He added, with what seemed a perfectly natural curiosity,
Do you mean to say you've never heard anything of her since Dilmouth 18 years ago?
Nothing.
No letters?
There were two letters, said Giles, but we have some reason to think that she didn't write them.
You think she didn't write them?
Affleck seemed faintly amused.
Sound like a mystery on the flicks.
That's rather what it seems like to us.
Well, what about her brother, the doctor chap? Doesn't he know where she is?
No.
I see. Regular mystery, isn't it? Why not advertise?
We have.
Affleck said casually, Looks as though she's dead. You mightn't have heard.
Gwenda shivered.
Cold, Mrs. Reed?
No. I was thinking of Helen, dead. I don't like to think of her dead.
You're right there. I don't like to think of it myself. Stunning look she had.
Gwenda said impulsively, You knew her. You knew her well. I've only got a child's memory of her. What was she like? What did people feel about her? What did you feel?
He looked at her for a moment or two. I'll be honest with you, Mrs. Reed. Believe it or not, as you like, I was sorry for the kid.
Sorry?
She turned a puzzled stare on him. Just that. There she was, just home from school, longing for a bit of fun like any girl might, and there was that stiff middle-aged brother of hers with his ideas about what a girl could do and couldn't do.
No fun at all, that kid hadn't. Well, I took her about a bit, showed her a bit of life. I wasn't really keen on her, and she wasn't really keen on me. She just liked the fun of being a daredevil. Then, of course, they found out we were meeting, and he put a stop to it. Don't blame him, really. Cut above me, she was. We weren't engaged or anything of that kind. I meant to marry some time, but not till I was a good bit older. And I meant to get on and to find a wife who'd help me get on. Helen hadn't any money, and it wouldn't have been a suitable match in any way. We were just good friends with a bit of flirtation thrown in.
But you must have been angry with the doctor.
Gwenda paused, and Affleck said, I was riled, I admit. You don't fancy being told you're not good enough. But there, it's no good being thin-skinned.
And then, said Giles, you lost your job.
Affleck's face was not quite so pleasant. Fired, I was. Out of Fane and Watchman's, and I've a very good idea who was responsible for that.
Oh?
Giles made his tone interrogative, but Affleck shook his head. I'm not saying anything. I've got my own ideas. I was framed, that's all, and I got a very fair idea of who did it. And why?
The colour suffused his cheeks.
Dirty work, he said. Spying on a man, laying traps for him, lying about him. Oh, I've had my enemies, all right. But I've never let them get me down, and I've always given as good as I got. And I don't forget.
He stopped. Suddenly, his manner changed back again. He was genial once more.
So, I can't help you, I'm afraid. A little bit of fun between me and Helen, that was all. It didn't go deep.
Gwenda stared at him. It was a clear enough story, but was it true, she wondered. Something jarred. It came to the surface of her mind what that something was.
All the same, she said, you looked her up when you came to Dilmouth later.
He laughed.
You got me there, Mrs. Reed. Yes, I did. Wanted to show her, perhaps, that I wasn't down and out just because a long-faced lawyer had pushed me out of his office. I had a nice business, and I was driving a posh car, and I'd done very well for myself.
You came to see her more than once, didn't you? He hesitated a moment.
Twice, perhaps three times. Just dropped in.
He nodded with sudden finality.
Sorry, I can't help you.
Giles got up. We must apologize for taking up so much of your time.
That's all right. Quite a change to talk about old times.
The door opened, and a woman looked in and apologized swiftly. Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know you had anyone.
Come in, my dear, come in. Meet my wife. This is Mr. and Mrs. Reed.
Mrs. Affleck shook hands. She was a tall, thin, depressed-looking woman, dressed in rather unexpectedly well-cut clothes.
Been talking over old times, we have, said Mr. Affleck. Old times before I met you, Dorothy.
He turned to them.
Met my wife on a cruise, he said. She doesn't come from this part of the world. Cousin of Lord Polterham's, she is.
He spoke with pride. The thin woman flushed.
They're very nice, these cruises, said Giles. Very educational, said Affleck. Now, I didn't have any education to speak of.
I always tell my husband we must go on one of those Hellenic cruises, said Mrs. Affleck.
No time. I'm a busy man.
And we mustn't keep you, said Giles. Goodbye, and thank you. You'll let me know about the quotation for the outing? Affleck escorted them to the door. Gwenda glanced back over her shoulder. Mrs. Affleck was standing in the doorway of the study. Her face, fastened on her husband's back, was curiously and rather unpleasantly apprehensive. Giles and Gwenda said goodbye again and went towards their car.
Oh, bother! I've left my scarf, said Gwenda.
You're always leaving something, said Giles.
Don't look martyred. I'll get it.
She ran back into the house. Through the open door of the study, she heard Affleck say loudly,
What do you want to come butting in for? Never any sense.
I'm sorry, Jackie. I didn't know. Who are those people, and why have they upset you so?
They haven't upset me.
He stopped as he saw Gwenda standing in the doorway.
Oh, Mr. Affleck, did I leave a scarf?
Scarf? No, Mrs. Reed, it's not here.
Oh,
stupid of me. It must be in the car. She went out again. Giles had turned the car. Drawn up by the curb was a large yellow limousine, resplendent with chromium.
Some car, said Giles.
A posh car, said Gwenda. Do you remember, Giles? Edith Paget, when she was telling us what Lily said? Lily had put her money on Captain Erskine, not our mystery man in the flashy car. Well, don't you see? The mystery man in the flashy car was Jackie Affleck. Yes, said Giles, and in her letter to the doctor, Lily mentioned a posh car.
They looked at each other.
He was there, on the spot, as Miss Marple would say, on that night. Oh, Giles, I can hardly wait until Thursday to hear what Lily Kimball says.
Suppose she gets cold feet and doesn't turn up after all.
Oh, she'll come. Giles, if that flashy car was there that night...
Think it was a yellow peril like this? Admiring my bus.
Mr. Affleck's genial voice made them jump. He was leaning over the neatly clipped hedge behind them.
Little Buttercup, that's what I call her. I've always liked a nice bit of bodywork. Hits you in the eye, doesn't she?
She certainly does, said Giles.
Fond of flowers, I am, said Mr. Affleck. Daffodils, buttercups, calceolarias, they're all my fancy. Here's your scarf, Mrs. Reed. It had slipped down behind the table. Goodbye. Pleased to have met you.
Do you think he heard us calling his car a yellow peril? Asked Gwenda as they drove away.
Oh, I don't think so. He seemed quite amiable, didn't he?
Giles looked slightly uneasy.
Yes, but I don't think that means much.
Giles, that wife of his, she's frightened of him. I saw her face.
What? That jovial, pleasant chap?
Perhaps he isn't so jovial and pleasant underneath. Giles, I don't think I like Mr. Affleck. I wonder how long he'd been there behind us, listening to what we were saying. Just what did we say?
Nothing much, said Giles,
but he still looked uneasy. Chapter 22 Lily keeps an appointment.
Well, I'm damned, exclaimed Giles.
He had just torn open a letter that had arrived by the after-lunch post, and was staring in complete astonishment at its contents.
What's the matter?
It's the report of the handwriting experts, Gwenda said eagerly.
And she didn't write that letter from abroad?
That's just it, Gwenda. She did.
They stared at each other. Gwenda said incredulously,
Then those letters weren't a fake. They were genuine. Helen did go away from the house that night, and she did write from abroad, and she wasn't strangled at all.
Giles said slowly, It seems so, but it really is very upsetting. I don't understand it, just as everything seems to be pointing the other way.
Perhaps the experts are wrong.
I suppose they might be, but they seem quite confident.
Gwenda, I really don't understand a single thing about all this. Have we been making the most colossal idiots of ourselves? All based on my silly behaviour at the theatre? I tell you what, Giles, let's call round on Miss Marple. We'll have time before we get to Dr. Kennedy's at 4:30.
Miss Marple, however, reacted rather differently from the way they had expected. She said it was very nice indeed.
But, darling Miss Marple, said Gwenda, what do you mean by that?
I mean, my dear, that somebody hasn't been as clever as they might have been.
But how? In what way?
Slipped up, said Miss Marple, nodding her head with satisfaction.
But how?
Well, my dear Mr. Reed, surely you can see how it narrows the field.
Accepting the fact that Helen actually wrote the letters, do you mean that she might still have been murdered?
I mean that it seemed very important to someone that the letters should actually be in Helen's handwriting.
I see. At least, I think I see. There must be certain possible circumstances in which Helen
could have been induced to write those particular letters. That would narrow things down, but what circumstances exactly?
Oh, come now, Mr. Reed. You're not really thinking. It's perfectly simple, really.
Giles looked annoyed and mutinous. It's not obvious to me, I can assure you.
If you just reflect a little.
Come on, Giles, said Gwenda. We'll be late. They left Miss Marple smiling to herself. That old woman annoys me sometimes, said Giles. I don't know now what the hell she was driving at. They reached Dr. Kennedy's house in good time. The doctor himself opened the door to them. I've let my housekeeper go out for the afternoon, he explained. It seemed to be better. He led the way into the sitting room, where a tea tray with cups and saucers, bread and butter and cakes was ready. Cup of tea's a good move, isn't it? He asked, rather uncertainly, of Gwenda. Put this Mrs. Kimball at her ease and all that.
Oh, you're absolutely right, said Gwenda.
Now, what about you two? Shall I introduce you straight away, or will it put her off?
Gwenda said slowly, Country people are very suspicious. I think it would be better if you received her alone.
I think so too, said Giles. Dr. Kennedy said, If you were to wait in the room next door, and if this communicating door was slightly ajar, you would be able to hear what went on. Under the circumstances of the case, I think that you would be justified.
I suppose it's eavesdropping, but I really don't care, said Gwenda.
Dr. Kennedy smiled faintly and said, I don't think any ethical principle is involved. I do not propose, in any case, to give a promise of secrecy, though I am willing to give my advice if I am asked for it. He glanced at his watch. The train is due at Woodley Road at 4:35. It should arrive in a few minutes now. Then it will take her about 5 minutes to walk up the hill. He walked restlessly up and down the room. His face was lined and haggard. I don't understand, he said. I don't understand in the least what it all means. If Helen never left that house, if her letters to me were forgeries... Gwenda moved sharply, but Giles shook his head at her. The doctor went on. If Kelvin, poor fellow, didn't kill her, then what on earth did happen?
Somebody else killed her, said Gwenda.
But, my dear child, if somebody else killed her, why on earth should Kelvin insist that he had done so?
Because he thought he had. He found her there on the bed, and he thought he had done it. That could happen, couldn't it?
Dr. Kennedy rubbed his nose irritably. How should I know? I'm not a psychiatrist. Shock. Nervous condition already? Well, yes, I suppose it's possible. But who would want to kill Helen?
We think one of three people, said Gwenda.
Three people? What three people? Nobody could have any possible reason for killing Helen, unless they were completely off their heads. She'd no enemies. Everybody liked her. He went to the desk drawer and fumbled through its contents. He held out a faded snapshot. It showed a tall schoolgirl in a gym tunic, her hair tied back, her face radiant. Kennedy, a younger, happy-looking Kennedy, stood beside her, holding a terrier puppy. I've been thinking a lot about her lately, he said indistinctly. For many years I hadn't thought about her at all, almost managed to forget. Now, I think about her all the time. That's your doing.
His words sounded almost accusing. I think it's her doing, said Gwenda.
He wheeled round on her sharply. What do you mean?
Just that. I can't explain. But it's not really us. It's Helen herself.
The faint, melancholy scream of an engine came to their ears. Dr. Kennedy stepped out of the window and they followed him. A trail of smoke showed itself retreating slowly along the valley. There goes the train, said Kennedy. Coming into the station? No, leaving it. He paused. She'll be here any minute now. But the minutes passed, and Lily Kimball did not come. Lily Kimball got out of the train at Dilmouth Junction and walked across the bridge to the siding where the little local train was waiting. There were few passengers, a half-dozen at most. It was a slack time of day, and in any case it was market day at Helchester. Presently the train started, puffing its way importantly along a winding valley. There were three stops before the terminus at Lonsbury Bay: Newton Langford, Matching's Holt for Woodley Camp, and Woodley Bolton. Lily Kimball looked out of the window with eyes that did not see the lush countryside, but saw instead a Jacobean suite upholstered in jade green. She was the only person to alight at the tiny station of Matching's Holt. She gave up her ticket and went out through the booking office. A little way along the road, a signpost with "To Woodley Camp" indicated a footpath leading up a steep hill. Lily Kimball took the footpath and walked briskly uphill. The path skirted the side of a wood. On the other side, the hill rose steeply, covered with heather and gorse. Someone stepped out from the trees, and Lily Kimball jumped.
"Oh, my! You did give me a start!" she exclaimed. "I wasn't expecting to meet you here."
"Gave you a surprise, did I? I've got another surprise for you." It was very lonely in among the trees. There was no one to hear a cry or a struggle. Actually, there was no cry, and the struggle was very soon over. A wood-pigeon, disturbed, flew out of the wood.
"What can have become of the woman?" demanded Dr. Kennedy irritably.
The hands of the clock pointed to 5:10.
Could she have lost her way coming from the station? I gave her explicit directions. In any case, it's quite simple. Turn to the left when she got out of the station, and then take the first road to the right. As I say, it's only a 5 minutes' walk.
Perhaps she changed her mind, said Giles.
It looks like it.
Or missed the train, suggested Gwenda. Kennedy said slowly,
No, I think it's more likely that she decided not to come after all. Perhaps her husband stepped in. All these country people are quite incalculable.
He walked up and down the room. Then he went to the telephone and asked for a number.
Hello? Is that the station? This is Dr. Kennedy speaking. I was expecting someone by the 4:35. Middle-aged countrywoman. Did anyone ask to be directed to me? Or what do you say?
The others were near enough to hear the soft, lazy accent of Woodley Bolton's one porter.
Don't think it could be anyone for you, doctor. Weren't no strangers on the 4:35. Mr. Narracott's from Meadows and Johnny Laws and old Benson's daughter. Weren't no other passengers at all.
So she changed her mind, said Dr. Kennedy.
Well, I can offer you tea. The kettle's on. I'll go out and make it. He returned with the teapot, and they sat down.
"It's only a temporary check," he said, more cheerfully. "We've got her address. We'll go over and see her, perhaps."
The telephone rang, and the doctor got up to answer.
"Dr. Kennedy?"
"Speaking.
This is Inspector Last, Longford Police Station. Were you expecting a woman called Lily Kimball, Mrs. Lily Kimball, to call upon you this afternoon?"
"I was. Why? Has there been an accident?"
Not what you'd call an accident, exactly. She's dead. We found a letter from you on the body. That's why I rang you up. Can you make it convenient to come along to Longford Police Station as soon as possible?
I'll come at once.
Now, let's get this quite clear, Inspector Last was saying.
He looked from Kennedy to Giles and Gwenda, who had accompanied the doctor. Gwenda was very pale and held her hands tightly clasped together.
You were expecting this woman by the train that leaves Dilmouth Junction at 4:05 and gets to Woodley Bolton at 4:35.
Dr. Kennedy nodded. Inspector Last looked down at the letter he had taken from the dead woman's body. It was quite clear. Dear Mrs. Kimball, Dr. Kennedy had written, I shall be glad to advise you to the best of my power. As you will see from the heading of this letter, I no longer live in Dilmouth. If you will take the train leaving Coombe Lee at 3:30, change at Dilmouth Junction, and come by the Lonsbury Bay train to Woodley Bolton, my house is only a 5 minutes' walk. Turn to the left as you come out of the station, then take the first road on the right. My house is at the end of it on the right. The name is on the gate. Yours truly, James Kennedy.
There was no question of her coming by an earlier train?
An earlier train?
Dr. Kennedy looked astonished.
Because that's what she did. She left Coombe Lee not at 3:30, but at 1:30, caught the 2:05 from Dilmouth Junction, and got out, not at Woodley Bolton, but at Matching's Holt, the station before it.
But that's extraordinary,
Was she consulting you professionally, Doctor?
No, I retired from practice some years ago.
That's what I thought. You knew her well?
Kennedy shook his head.
I hadn't seen her for nearly 20 years.
But you recognized her just now?
Gwenda shivered. But dead bodies did not affect a doctor, and Kennedy replied thoughtfully,
Under the circumstances, it is hard to say if I recognized her or not.
She was strangled, I presume.
She was strangled. The body was found in a copse a short way along the track leading from Matcham's Halt to Woodley Camp. It was found by a hiker coming down from the camp at about 4:10. Our police surgeon puts the time of death at between 2:15 and 3 o'clock. Presumably she was killed shortly after she left the station. No other passengers got out at Matching's Halt. She was the only person to get out of the train there. Now, why did she get out at Matching's Halt? Did she mistake the station? I hardly think so. In any case, she was 2 hours early for her appointment with you, and had not come by the train you suggested, although she had your letter with her. Now, just what was her business with you, Doctor?
End of Disc 4.